I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The director of the FBI from 1993 to 2001, Louis Free, testified before the 9/11 Commission today, saying his agency's ability to prevent 9/11 was frustrated by Congress not providing enough money and resources, by laws that erected a wall between intelligence agents and law enforcement agents, and by the lack of a formal declaration of war against al-Qaeda, which would have changed the rules of the game for more aggressive pursuit of terrorists. Former Senator Bob Kerry asked about the September 11th hijackers.
Why did we let them in?
Well, again, I think part of my answer is that we weren't fighting a real war. We hadn't declared war on these enemies in the manner that you suggest that would have prevented entry had we taken war measures and put the country and its intelligence and law enforcement agencies on a war footing.
After Free's testimony, his boss for his tenure in the Clinton administration, former Attorney General Janet Reno, also testified.
When I came into office, I learned that the FBI didn't know what it had. We found stuff in files here that the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing.
Well, joining me on the line is Michael Vadas, who was deputy director of the National Security Office at the Department of Justice under President Clinton. He also worked on cyber terrorism at the FBI. Hello, Michael.
Good afternoon.
Michael, thanks for joining us. The staff report read before Free's testimony began was referred to by Commission head Thomas Kane as an indictment of the FBI. Here's Kane's question and Free's response.
The present director, your successor, has a whole series of reforms that he is trying to put to make the agency work better. You tried reforms. You tried very hard to reform the agency. According to our staff report, those reforms failed. I guess my question to you is, looking at this director's efforts to reform the agency, can those reforms work, or should there be some more fundamental changes to the agency and the way we get our intelligence?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I take exception to your comment that your staff report is an indictment of the FBI. I think your staff report evidences some very good work and some very diligent interviews and a very technical, almost auditing analysis of some of the programs. I think the centerpiece of your executive director's report, as I heard it, came down to resources and legal authorities.
Louis Free, former FBI director, taking exception to very tough criticism of his agency today. Michael Vadas, how did Free come off?
I think he came off fairly well. I think he came off, understandably so, a bit defensive. I think he's right that Chairman Kane was probably exaggerating the nature of the staff report. I wouldn't read it as an indictment. I think it was a fairly moderate, level-headed analysis of shortcomings at the FBI. And I think Director Free's interpretation of it as really coming down to resources and legal authorities was also a misconstruction. So I think the truth lies somewhere between Kane's analysis and Free's analysis. I think there was a lot more going on than just resources and legal issues that had actually more of a bearing on what we all see now as the shortcomings in the FBI's performance.
We're joined now as well by Steve Pomerantz. Steve's a 27-year veteran of the FBI who was former counterterrorism chief under Presidents Reagan and George Bush Sr. Steve, I want your thoughts just in general on how Louis Free came off today.
Oh, I think he did well. I think Louis is a direct talking person, and I think that's what you heard today. You know, you mentioned my 27 years. I do go back a long way. And I'll tell you from my vantage point, I think it's unfortunate that the FBI has been singled out in a sense, certainly right now, for criticism when the problem in counterterrorism is and the U.S. government's failure to properly address the terrorism issue goes back decades, begins with our political leadership, extends through Congress. And I think it's very unfortunate that the people who are on the front lines, particularly in this country, have to bear the brunt of a lot of criticism, much of which is unwarranted. Certainly there's room for improvement. Well, I'm not suggesting that, but
yeah, sure. Steve, one thing that did come up though, the Phoenix memo. That's the classified memo written by Phoenix FBI agent Kenneth Williams, saying extremists might be training in U.S. flight schools. The memo came out the summer before 9/11. The FBI took no action. Let's hear an exchange between former Congressman Timothy Romer and Louis Free this morning.
This agent asks that two things be done. One, that the FBI should accumulate a listing of civil aviation universities and colleges around the country and share these with the appropriate liaison. And two, that the FBI should discuss this matter with other elements of U.S. intelligence community. Neither one of those is done. Now, I agree with you. This is not the roadmap to 9/11, but it's certainly asking to do two things to New York and headquarters. Neither one of them are done. Why not?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't answer that, obviously, for the time and space reasons that are obvious. I could speculate on it, and what I would say is that, you know, the simple fact or the apparent simple fact of getting from all of those civil aviation schools around the United States, you know, names and identifying information of those students, first of all, you would have had to overcome a couple of federal statutes that prevent educational institutions from giving that information out without a subpoena or a grand jury request.
Well, Steve Pomerantz, I want to ask you, why not get the subpoenas that were necessary? Why wasn't more aggressive action taken after the Phoenix memo?
I'm glad you used the word aggressive. Let me tell you that for 20 years preceding September 11th, the FBI was not aggressive in pursuit of intelligence information in this country. The political climate, quite frankly, simply did not allow for aggressive collection of domestic intelligence. Look at the Williams memo. He is essentially suggesting, in hindsight accurately, that there was a problem, particularly with Middle East people of Middle Eastern origins attending flight school. I would like to suggest to you that in a pre-9/11 environment, to initiate an investigation based on ethnicity, which is what he's saying in that memo, would have not, if I were back in my decision-making capacity at the FBI, I wouldn't have approved that because of the climate that existed in terms of the FBI's intelligence.
Michael Vattis, there was a climate that just made more aggressive action impossible?
Well, I think that there certainly was a very different climate pre-9/11, and civil liberties and privacy in particular were foremost considerations in the minds of people at the Bureau because of all of the scandals going back to the 70s and the reforms that were instituted. And there was a real chilling effect on legitimate investigative activity that came out of those things. And I think it's important for all of us, and especially for the 9/11 Commission, not to judge pre-9/11 activities through the lens of what we all, the way we think of things now, post-9/11. And the other thing I think to keep in mind, and I think Steve is right about this, that we are seeing, especially in the last week, a very, very clear and pronounced effort by the administration to put the blame for 9/11 on the FBI. I think we're seeing now from Condi Rice's testimony, from the fact that the White House was forced to release the August 6th President's Daily Brief, that they're feeling a lot of political heat, and the easiest place for them to deflect blame is to the FBI. Now, you know, I am the first to say that there were lots of shortcomings in the way the FBI utilized the information that it collected, and it needs to do a much better job of analyzing and sharing the information that it receives within the Bureau, with other agencies, especially the intelligence community. But it's a very complicated situation, and there is blame that should go all around it. And I hate to see, for political reasons, the FBI get singled out.
Free repeatedly said he didn't have the resources he needed, pointing out that only 3.5% of the anti-terrorism budget before 9/11 was dedicated to the FBI. He said from 2000 through 2002, he requested 1,895 new agents and translators and other personnel, but he got only 76. Let's listen to an exchange between former Congressman Lee Hamilton and Free on the question of resources.
Maybe I'm a little sensitive to this because of my experience in the Congress. I took a quick look at the appropriations for the FBI from 1996 to 2001. It went up from $2.3 billion to $3.3 billion, roughly. That's a very, very dramatic increase. The amount of FBI personnel and funding dedicated to counterterrorism more than tripled.
Now, this made former FBI Chief Louis Freeh a bit defensive. Again, he said, look, I only got 200 more agents between 2000 and 2002. I believe those were the dates. Between 1999 and 2001, only 200 more FBI agents. What do you make of that, Steve Pomerantz?
You know, I can't speak to the resource issue because I wasn't in charge of that program during that time. I accept that what Louis says in terms of the limitations that that placed on the Bureau, the resource issue. But I think it really there are larger issues than resources. We terrorism simply had not been perceived as a front rank issue. That's the answer to the question of why people, for example, the question that we heard in the earlier exchange, why individuals got in this country who should not have, because people weren't watching. People didn't care. We let all kinds of suspicious people with terrorist backgrounds in this country, and more than that, once the FBI identified them as being here, we couldn't get anybody interested in deporting them. The political climate, the restrictions placed on the FBI's collection of intelligence, those were the major factors that led to the kinds of weaknesses that were exploited on September 11th, in
Michael,
my opinion.
Michael Vadas, in the minute or so we have left, how much has changed? One issue that Freeh raised was he said, still to this day, there's not effective decoding of encrypted intelligence, for example. How much has changed? How reassured should Americans be?
Well, a lot has changed. I think Director Mueller is trying to effectuate a lot of reforms of the FBI and make sharing with other agencies a top priority, but there's still a long way to go. I think it would be a mistake to take away the counterterrorism mission and create what's called an MI5, a British Intelligence Service model, separate from the FBI, because as Janet Reno just testified less than an hour ago, if you create a new agency, you're just going to have one more player that needs to be coordinated. And I think it cuts against the traditions in this country to have an agency that works completely in secret with very little accountability and oversight that you have now with the FBI because it is primarily a law enforcement agency. And I think resources are not the only answer. The FBI throughout the Clinton administration received huge increases in resources. And in fact, it wasn't able to deploy them all quickly enough because the increases were so huge. And that's the of Louis Freeh's testimony.
Michael Vadas, I'm going to have to interrupt you there. I will say that as for that separate intelligence agency, which was brought up, Louis Freeh was vehemently opposed to that idea, saying it would create a secret police. I want to thank you both, Michael Vadas, who was deputy director of the National Security Office at the Department of Justice under President Clinton. Michael, thanks so much.
Okay, my pleasure.
And Steve Pomerantz, a veteran of the FBI. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Just ahead, why is the president holding a press conference tonight, and what one wife of a...
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
For only the third time in his presidency, George W. Bush will face the nation tonight in a televised press conference. Likely topics, today's 9/11 hearings and Iraq. Ed Chen is a political reporter with the L.A. Times. Ed, why the press conference now?
He has to do several things tonight. One is to be speaking to the American public in general, but also to allay the concerns of many Republicans in Congress and elsewhere around the country who are pretty nervous about what is happening in Iraq, and also because of the questions raised by the 9/11 Commission over the administration's handling of the warnings prior to 9/11. And so these are questions that the president wants to address, and he has, you know, for the last week been in Texas at his ranch and mostly out of sight, and this sort of disappearing act has made a lot of Republicans nervous.
I want to ask you about that because I'm wondering if it's seen as a mistake for the president to be on his Crawford Ranch as the 9/11 Commission is hearing about a briefing he received on the ranch a month before 9/11 and sent to some a message of a president, you know, sort of on vacation.
it's a pretty striking picture. But and I think that is why the White House earlier in the week went out of their way to tell us about all the phone calls and the video conference sessions the president held with his war commanders in Iraq, at Central Command, and with his national security advisors. In fact, we were told that one day he had two of those. He usually likes to play golf when he's there. He didn't this past week, even though the weather was gorgeous. He canceled one fishing outing with his father.
What is he expected to say tonight?
I think he's going to project what we've heard before, largely that this is not a time to go wobbly. He's going to stay the course, still aim for the June 30th deadline for transfer of sovereignty to the Iraqis.
We hear reports that President Bush sees a need to reorganize U.S. intelligence, and yet we just heard from Louis Free in particular that they don't like the idea of reorganizing U.S. intelligence. Do you think he'll broach that topic tonight?
He will certainly be asked about it. You know, he volunteered the information yesterday at a very brief press availability in Crawford at his ranch when a reporter tried to ask him, well, what are you thinking about? He cut off the reporter, so I'm sure he will be asked again tonight. There have been a lot of ideas and proposals out there for years to reorganize, and this administration and past ones have resisted doing so.
Ed Chen, thank you.
You're welcome.
Ed Chen, political reporter with the Los Angeles Times. He spoke to us from Washington. Katrina Owens will be listening closely to the president this evening. Katrina lives in Charlotte, North Carolina. Her husband, 34-year-old Sergeant Thomas Owens, is in Iraq. Katrina, what do you need to hear from the president this evening?
The main thing that I would like to hear is how long we anticipate the presence of our troops being in Iraq and how the rebuilding is going in the Iraqi council, when we will turn things over to them, what we anticipate happening there.
You're well aware that some of these are maybe unanswerable questions.
Yes, I'm very aware of that.
Yeah.
I'm just hoping for any bit of information in the foreseeable future of what they think will happen. Also interested in knowing, you know, of course, they stopped a lot of the troops from coming home, how long they will be extending those tour of duties and how long they think the troops will have to remain in theater there in Iraq.
And there's talk of sending more troops there. Is that something you support?
Yes, ma'am, I do. I actually believe we probably should have had more troops over there to begin with.
Yeah, I know that you're part of a family support group on the military base. Can you tell me what other people are also saying in this support group about, for instance, the last couple weeks of violence in Iraq?
We actually meet once a month, but there's about 10 to 12 of us that talk almost on a daily basis. We have a very close family support group here in Charlotte. We support our soldiers and our unit 100%. Nobody has really said anything derogatory. We know we have a mission. We know why we are there. We support that 100%. And, you know, we are reservists that have unfortunately had to give up our family members, be it male or female, for 18 months.
Yeah. So your husband is a reservist?
Yes, he is a reservist.
And your husband has served before?
Yes, ma'am. He was in Desert Storm.
What's different now?
From his side, the difference is he can communicate with us a lot better than what they were able to 11, 12 years ago. The communication between the units and, you know, say someone that's down at a base camp in Kuwait versus someone that is up in Iraq, the communication is just wonderful.
What about the sense of purpose?
Sense of purpose is, I believe everyone was ready to go. Everyone in our unit anyway was ready to go, especially the ones that had been there before, so they could go and bring peace to this country and do what they had intended to do years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, Katrina, you mentioned some of your concerns, some of the things you wanted to hear from President Bush. If you had one question to ask him tonight, what would it be?
I guess my main question to him would be what he hopes to accomplish by all of this. Would he be sure that we can free the Iraqi people, that they do want this freedom? I know the majority does. But how long? I have to watch what I say very closely also.
Because you want to be supportive.
Exactly. I want to be supportive, and I am.
Yeah.
you know, we're missing a husband and a father out of this house. I support him 100% in what he has to do. And if he has to stay there 2 years, then that is just something that this family is willing to sacrifice and willing to do. And so is he, even though he misses us.
But it sounds like you want to be sure, and you want to hear from President Bush that he's sure that the ultimate goal is achievable or even desirable on the part of the Iraqis.
That would be a good way to put it. Yes, my one question for the president would be, are we sure that we can accomplish what we have started this time? I would like to be reassured what the time frame is going to be, or at least an estimate of a time frame on when we can turn this over 100% to them and walk away and withdraw our troops out of there.
Yeah. Well, Katrina Owens, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Katrina Owens lives in Charlotte, North Carolina. Her husband, Sergeant Thomas Owens, is serving in Iraq.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, the 9/11 Commission's hearings resume. The director of the CIA will be questioned.
And Boston Pops conductor Keith Lockhart meets Tosca. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
And now the forecast for tomorrow's weather, cold and stormy. At least, that's the weather on the planet Saturn, traveling at almost 13,000 miles an hour. NASA's Cassini spacecraft is closing in on the giant planet and sending back spectacular new images of Saturn and its rings. One of the just-released photos shows two giant storms converging on Saturn's surface. For more, we're joined by Andrew Ingersoll, a member of the Cassini team and a planetary scientist at the California Institute of Technology. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you.
Andrew, we should say right away that listeners can see these spectacular new pictures from Cassini by visiting our website at here-now.org. And they are spectacular, aren't they? Describe them as best you can.
Well, we see two storms. Actually, we see a number of storms, but in particular, two of them that we were following throughout February and into March. They suddenly merge with each other. These are storms about the size of a terrestrial hurricane. And unlike terrestrial hurricanes, which just sort of run down, run out of energy, these seem to end their lives by merging with each other. And before there were two, and now there is one.
And do you see huge thunderclaps and lightning and rain? What's a storm on Saturn like, let alone a storm that merges with another one and creates a kind of superstorm?
So far, we have not seen thunder, lightning, or rain on Saturn, but we have seen, in fact, Cassini has seen lightning flashes on the night side of Jupiter a few years ago when Cassini went by Jupiter.
Now, these
giant planets do have rain and they do have lightning. These particular storms are really swirling masses of fluid, kind of like a terrestrial hurricane, except they're going around in the opposite direction. These are southern hemisphere hurricanes, but on Earth, southern hemisphere hurricanes go around clockwise, and these Saturn hurricanes go around counterclockwise.
And why is that?
Well, that's just one of the many things we're trying to figure out.
No.
It may have to do with the fact that Saturn has no solid surface. It's just a big ball of gas all the way down to the center. Another thing we're trying to understand is why the storms last so long on Saturn. And a third thing is why, at least at some latitudes, the winds are so strong. They're 10 times stronger than the Earth's jet stream.
Wow, which it means how strong?
Oh, 1,000 miles an hour wind speeds. Earth jet streams are maybe 100 miles an hour.
And how long can these storms last?
We don't know exactly, because we really started systematically observing the planet back around the 1st of February, and these storms were there at that time, and they went on for about a month and then merged with each other. So they could be quite old.
So what happens next? Cassini is hurtling towards Saturn. What can we expect over the next few months?
It's just going to get better because we get closer and closer. The closest approach is June 30th. So there's going to be good views of the rings, good views of Saturn's satellite Titan, which is a moon with an atmosphere thicker than the Earth's atmosphere, and good views of the icy satellites of Saturn. So it's going to be a great mission. And then we spend 4 years in orbit.
One thing that strikes one when you see these pictures is that, well, it sounds silly, but it really looks like Saturn. It looks so much like Saturn, it almost looks like a model.
Well, Saturn is really the most photogenic planet because of the beautiful rings, and it's a spectacular sight.
Tell me about those rings. Remind us why Saturn has rings and none of the other planets do. What are the rings?
Well, actually, we discovered when we got up close with the Voyager spacecraft that all the giant planets have rings. Rings are countless numbers of small particles ranging up in size to small boulders, and they're all orbiting together, just slowly grinding against each other very gently. And so you get this structure that almost looks solid, but it's in fact not solid. It's just bunches of boulders jammed together and orbiting.
All the big planets have rings, but we're not as aware of rings around Jupiter, I don't think, right?
No, you're quite right. You can't. The rings are so thin that you see through them on all the planets except Saturn.
Andrew, the Cassini spacecraft, how large is it?
It would be a very large SUV with a lot of stuff hanging off the ends, a lot of arms and booms and appendages.
Now, besides beautiful photographs and becoming aware of things like spectacular storms, what's the value of a Cassini spacecraft orbiting Saturn for years at a time eventually?
Well, there's several things. In my own field, which is meteorology, we can forecast the location of storms on Saturn months ahead because the storms last for months. So why can't we do that on Earth? Well, there's some fundamental difference between Earth and Saturn's weather that's telling us about predictability of weather. And so just understanding these processes in a larger context could be valuable for Earth. Another thing is Titan. Titan is this moon of Saturn with an atmosphere. And Titan's atmosphere is evolving. The chemistry of Titan keeps changing as the hydrogen floats away into space. And this is a model of how planets with atmospheres evolve, and it could be a model of the primitive Earth. So just understanding atmospheric evolution is very important.
Now, when Cassini gets to Saturn, it will also launch a probe, right?
Right. The probe goes into Titan's atmosphere to sample the chemistry and the winds. And also, the orbiter, which is going to have this four-year period going around Saturn, is going to have repeated looks through the clouds of Titan to see, for instance, if Titan has oceans. There's some theory that as the methane, which is a component of natural gas on Earth, when the methane loses its hydrogen, it forms higher hydrocarbons like, well, sort of like gasoline that could make oceans on the surface of Titan.
What's all this cost?
It's several billion dollars.
What do you think? Is this a better use of the limited funds out there than, say, the president's vision, which seems to have sort of dropped off the radar screen, of a manned mission to Mars?
I think so. I like to think that we're providing answers to questions that people have dreamed about from as long as there have been humans on the planet. You know, where do we come from and where are we going and what's out there? And even though maybe you don't put those questions in monetary value, they're important questions because people have been dreaming about them for so long. And I think that spacecraft like Cassini do the best job of providing the answers.
Andrew Ingersoll is a planetary scientist at the California Institute of Technology. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For the very latest pictures of Saturn, visit our website, year-now.org.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
And you can mail us a letter. Mail your letters to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
Still to come.
Japan's Minister of Defense canceled a trip to Iraq today, citing security concerns. Two Japanese aid workers and a photographer are still held hostage there after being abducted last week. And while eight Russian workers were released this morning, the American truck driver Thomas Hamill also remains in captivity. U.S. officials say there are as many as 40 hostages in Iraq from 12 countries. Well, through no choice of his own, Terry Anderson has become an expert on hostage-taking. He was the Associated Press chief Middle East correspondent in war-torn Lebanon when he was kidnapped and held hostage for 7 years in the late 80s. And Terry Anderson joins us on the line from Ohio. Welcome.
Thank you.
You know, some people might say you know how these hostages feel in Iraq, but I'm wondering if in some ways you are more prepared than they are.
I think probably so. I've been covering the Lebanon Civil War for several years. I'd covered wars and violence in Africa and the Middle East. Of course, I'd been a Marine in Vietnam. Nobody's really prepared for this kind of thing, but if there's any preparation possible, I guess I had what you could. I mean, I look at these Japanese. These are kids. I mean, one of them's 18. This is terrible for them and for their families. It's got to be horribly frightening. And, of course, for the others from various and assorted countries, there doesn't seem to be any plan involved here. They're just snatching anybody they can get their hands on. Right.
And Thomas Hamill, as we mentioned yesterday on this program, was a dairy farmer a couple weeks before he went to Iraq. Well, as you know, governments can do many things in response to a hostage taking. In 1986, the Reagan administration secretly sold weapons to Iran while publicly...
A bad mistake, I might say.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Just to finish the thought, they were condemning Iran publicly as a terrorist state, traded arms for some hostages from the Iranian-backed Hezbollah in Lebanon. What should a government do?
Well, they certainly shouldn't give in to political demands. I mean, we tried trading weapons for hostages. It didn't work. We got some release, but more were kidnapped. It puts a high price on them. It makes them valuable. We learned that in the 1980s. And I don't think there's any question that any of the governments involved are going to give any political demands to the kidnappers. And I don't really think the kidnappers expect that. It's more a terrorism, an attention-getting, maybe a play for power among their own groups. But at this point, it doesn't seem to be very well organized at all.
Right. Well, from your vantage point, what can be done now?
Well, we can communicate. And I think the best way to communicate is through the existing Islamic leadership there. You have the Ayatollah Sistani, who is much more senior than the young rebel Sadr, who is sparking this revolution. How much control does even Sadr have over these groups that are kidnapping people? I don't know. But certainly, Shias follow personal leadership, and Ayatollah Sistani is the senior leader in Iraq. He needs to stand up publicly along with all the rest of the Islamic leadership and say, this is wrong, this is un-Islamic, it's contrary to the Quran, which it certainly is.
You spent 7 years studying the Quran when you were in captivity.
There are many prohibitions, but the clearest one says that you may not punish an innocent person for someone else's crime, and that's certainly what's going on here. Even if they think the United States government is guilty of some sort of crime, we need the Islamic leadership to stand up and condemn these kidnappings publicly and loudly, and we need them to use all their contacts within the militia groups in Iraq to stop it and to get these people released.
Terry Anderson, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Former Associated Press Chief Middle East Correspondent Terry Anderson speaking to us from Ohio.
Stay with us. There's more. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
British actress Dame Helen Mirren has won acclaim for her work on stage with the Royal Shakespeare Company on screen in such films as Gosford Park and last year's Calendar Girls. But she achieved cult status with her Emmy Award-winning character Jane Tennyson in the PBS series Prime Suspect. Tennyson is a detective with London's Metropolitan Police who must fend off sexism, ageism, and, on behalf of others, racism, while also fighting crime. In the latest outing, Prime Suspect 6, The Last Witness, Jane is investigating the death of a young Bosnian Muslim girl, and at 54, weighing the opportunity offered by her superiors to retire.
You've got your 30 years, so there's no financial penalty attached to taking retirement now. If you choose to stay on, there are a number of new challenges.
I don't feel my age compromises my ability. I think my experience is an asset. I have 3 murder teams under my command. That's 80 officers working 24 murder cases. And I can give you a breakdown on each and every case if you so wish.
Superintendent, this review isn't intended to be confrontational. It's entirely for your benefit.
Joining us from New York is Dame Helen Mirren. Welcome.
Hi there. Please don't call me Dame Helen Mirren.
I wasn't sure. So Helen it is, right?
Yes, exactly. But
this also reflects how much you've been honored for your acting. Is that something that's dawning on you?
Yes. I mean, it's not exactly a poisoned chalice, but it's a double-edged sword.
Because?
It is a great honor, and I was, thrilled, absolutely thrilled, as the daughter of an immigrant, to be recognized by the country. On the other hand, it's a kind of an establishment thing, and it sort of smacks of just being a bit old and a bit fuddy-duddy to me.
Well, speaking of which, we just heard this scene where we're in the new Prime Suspect. Jane Tennyson, and those of us who are huge fans of Jane Tennyson, were, I think, appalled along with her that at the age of 54, she was being asked to consider retiring. Did you identify with that shock that she seems to register?
No. I mean, I'm longing to retire. That sounds like a great idea to me. I don't see that scene as being particularly racist or ageist. I think what it is more is that they would just quite like Jane to retire, They want to get rid of her specifically.
Because
I think she's a bit of a pain, She's notoriously sort of a bit of a pain, I guess.
You get the feeling, what would she do if she weren't doing this?
Well, exactly. It's what she loves and it's what she's good at, and she doesn't want to stop doing it. She's not ready.
Another aspect of what Jane Tennyson, your character, is now confronting, right at the top of the program, the two storylines seem to collide. We see this poor murder victim in an autopsy, and your character in a physical. And we see quite a bit of your character. You look terrific. You've been quite the sex symbol, as you know, in your day, for both your brains and your body. But any hesitancy in showing your body now?
No. No, not really. I don't give a damn anymore. No. I mean, the great thing is that, the sort of age is liberating on that level. And I think it's a relief for everyone. It's a relief for everyone out there who are trying to look at these impossible ideals and trying to live up to them, and going, oh, I see, they're just like we are. Oh, I get it.
Well, as we said, the storyline of the mystery behind this particular prime suspect has to do with the immigrant community. And in confronting this murder that involves the immigrant community, Jane Tennyson has to face attitudes of her own staff. Let's listen to a little exchange there.
Look, I don't know what kind of limited ideas you may hold about the community we serve, but they better expand to include Kazim Ibrahimovic and Yasmina Blekic.
Yes, ma'am.
There is a 12-week residential course I could send you on that is specially designed to help you appreciate cultural sensitivities.
It's a very relevant issue in England at this moment in time. In fact, more so now than when we started this filming it.
And it's a ghost community. We do not exist, they say. They actually are called ghosts.
Yes, yes. They supply an incredible service, but yes, they don't exist legally. I love that image of the hotel, their hotel workers. And it's true, I've stayed in many beautiful hotels and, you're in this gorgeous room with the lovely antiques and the beautiful drapes. And if you peek through a door that says service on it, you do go into a completely different world of peeling paint and neon light and no windows. And the people who are servicing you in that hotel are living in that world, and you never see them.
In preparing for this role, we understand that you talked and shadowed members of Britain's police department. How do they like Jane Tennyson?
They love Jane Tennyson. Mm-hmm. They love her not, you know, the prime suspect has always been quite critical of the police, but at the same time it's very realistic about the police and about their life and about their work, and I think that they really appreciate that.
On the other hand, Jane Tennyson is very brilliant at her job, but very bad at her personal life. We mentioned that she had the scene with her superiors who were offering her retirement. She turns around and has an interaction with a younger female member of her squad, a young mother, and I'd love your take on that, but first let's listen.
Lorna, I think you should think very carefully about whether the murder squad is the right place for you.
Is there a specific complaint against me?
No. It's just that... Well, I need officers who can put the hours in.
I work all the hours.
I need more than just the rule book.
I'm sorry, but this is discrimination. As the mother of two small children, I might occasionally be at a disadvantage compared to a single male officer. But I think it's totally unfair for me to be penalised because of it.
Well, I think she's basically saying it's all or nothing. You know, this is not a 9-to-5 job. This is a job that requires total commitment. But I never wanted it to make it into a sort of feminist tract about how difficult it was to have a job and a family. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She just is who she is. That's all there is to it. You know, she has no regrets about who she is. She's carrying on doing what she's doing, you know, with pleasure, and there's no... Oh my God, why didn't I get married and have children? I mean, I thought it was a great thing, and that was Peter Barry, the writer, who brought that in, that sort of instant criticism of someone. You know, you can't be a mother and a top policewoman. I'm sorry, you just can't.
She is who she is. Your fans are finding out a lot more about who you are. Lately, there's been a topic bandied about in the British press. I'm hoping that it's with your permission, a story about how when you were much younger, you were date raped, and how it affected your attitudes towards men.
Oh, you've just done me a great favor, which is you've just earned me $10.
Because you bet that I would ask you?
Yeah, I bet myself. I pay myself $10 if anyone ever asks me about that.
Well, but we understood in our reading, and I hope that's why I said I hope I'm right, that it was that you brought up the topic, that you
I brought it up, but in a completely different context, and then it was completely taken out of context and exaggerated. I never made an issue of it, and I'm not going to make an issue of it now.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, is there something you'd like to share about yourself with people who are your fans who want to know a little more about Helen Mirren, the actress behind the character?
I mean, I've always been very open in my dealings with the press and with talking to people. I don't believe in being secretive and hiding away. You know, I've got sort of nothing to hide, really. But on the other hand, you know, there are certain things, obviously, which are private, and and certain things that you're not beholden to talk about. You know, it's hard to... It's very hard to deconstruct yourself, you know. I'm not particularly interested in myself like that. I've never been to a shrink. I can't, you know, the whole idea of therapy I find rather abhorrent. I allow my behavior to inform people as to what I'm like.
Where do you think Jane Tennyson will be 20 years from now if you have to see your character down the road? What's she going to be doing?
I have no idea. She's not a real person anyway, so it's completely irrelevant.
Just
hopefully
testing
I'll
you.
I'll be sitting in Barbados somewhere, you know, thinking, thank you, Jane Tennyson, you put me here.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Dame Helen Mirren's latest project, the Masterpiece Theatre production Prime Suspect 6, The Last Witness. It's scheduled to air this Sunday on PBS stations across the country.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.